This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
In many different ways, the world is going through paradigm shifts, radical changes in how people view the world or in what they are going to tolerate or not tolerate from their politicos and some of the changes that they see that they don't like. Maybe some of these are good, some of these are bad, but they are paradigm shifts. I guess here in the United States, we're going through a Trumpian revolution. Welcome to the big picture for this week here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. You know, when President Bush came in, he changed the military. Then we had 9/11. We had the Iraq War. He did cut taxes and he changed what happened in the markets and the economy. And of course, we also saw what happened right at the tail end of his presidency when we had the markets crash due to a whole different series of factors, which we have discussed. Then President Obama came in, raised taxes, raised regulation. These basically stifled the economy, not to mention Obamacare at the time, because it threw a lot of businesses, especially middle level and small businesses, into a tailspin, not knowing what it was they were going to be facing. They froze hiring. Now, Mr. Trump, president-elect, will be coming in, and he says all of this garbage didn't work under Obama, and we've had a measly 1% GDP growth. We're going to have to change it. Now, what that change means, both in the economy and the market, remains to be seen, but it's really clear that he's going to be facing some possible headwinds because Janet Yellen at the Fed is talking about raising interest rates, and that may counteract some of the things Mr. Trump is trying to do. But that's the subject of what we're looking at today, and of course, always how it affects investments. And we're not the only one, by the way, facing changes. I mean, obviously, Great Britain went through an astounding Brexit vote, which had almost exactly the same kind of overturn halfway through the voting process and had an outcome that people didn't expect. We jump over here. We had the Trump election, which was an overturn. Italy has elections and a referendum coming up. And more importantly, François Hollande has announced he is going to be stepping down, president of France. Angela Merkel is actually hanging in there at the moment. But I noticed, Jim, this week she is saying that, well, I'm listening to what people are saying. I would think that would be wise on her part, because you have to recognize that when the populist movement first appeared on the scene, you know, the first wins you got of it here were in the early 1990s. Then it really made an effort during the Tea Party movement in 2008. And now it's back again with much force. Same thing in Europe. And when these things were first coming out, they were derided, you know, denigrated, ridiculed. But they're having to be dealt with now as a force in politics.
It's amazing because we're calling this the Trumpian Revolution, because as you take a look at the last 16 years, we've had two presidents that served two terms. First, George Bush, beginning the new millennium, and now recently with Obama, and we don't know what's going to happen with Trump, but at least he's got one term. And there are major differences. There were some very close similarities between Bush and Obama when they began their office. George Bush took office in 2001, he inherited a recession. The Fed under Greenspan at that time was in a monetary loosening mode. So there was a monetary tailwind that he had to help propel the economy forward. Now, like Obama, Bush expanded the deficit. He did that with the Iraq War, expanding the military, and also adding a new entitlement to Medicare called Medicare Part D. He also cut taxes. He cut the top tax rate, which was 39.6 under Clinton, along with the Pease Amendment, which phased out part of your itemized deductions. He got rid of that, lowered capital gains, lowered the dividend tax, and lowered tax rates to 35%. So he lowered the top tax rate by 4 percentage points. And what we experienced was faster economic growth, but unfortunately, there was also a bubble that was developing in the real estate market and mortgage market. Fast forward, Obama comes in. Like his predecessor, George Bush, Obama inherits a recession. And like his predecessor, he has a monetary tailwind, first with Bernanke, and then eventually with Janet Yellen. And like Bush, he doubled the national debt. What's amazing is in Obama's term, he has added more debt than all the presidents combined that preceded him, because the national debt, Bush inherited a national debt of $5 trillion. He took it to $10 trillion. And then Obama came in at $10 trillion, and it'll be $20 trillion when he leaves office. He expanded entitlements, mainly Obamacare, welfare, food stamps. He raised taxes. Tax rates now, the top tax rate, if you add the 39.6, the phasing out of itemized deductions, the Medicare tax, all of it added up to 44%. He expanded the power of government, doubling regulations. Now, fast forward to Trump. He's inheriting an anemic economic recovery. The GDP growth this year will come in under 2%. And he's also inheriting an aging business cycle. This recovery began in the summer of 2009. It's now 7-8 years into its duration. He's also, unlike his two predecessors, instead of a monetary tailwind, he is facing monetary headwinds. It's widely expected that when the Fed meets on December 12th and 13th, the Fed will be raising interest rates. And quite honestly, what we simply don't know at this time is what the impact will be on the markets and the economy. We saw what happened when they raised last December. The stock market went down 6 weeks in a row, beginning in the beginning of the year when we saw commodity prices hit all-time low. He's also given his program and his agenda will be expanding the deficit. And like his Republican predecessor, George Bush, he's talking about cutting taxes. It's not all what it is played out to be for rich people. And I'm going to get into that. We're doing a special show on lifetime income if you want to listen to the impact of Trump's policies on taxes. But he wants to cut the tax rates to 33% from taking 7 brackets down to 3, a 33, a 25, and a 12%. He has also promised to cut regulations. He's going to increase infrastructure spending and increase defense spending. Like his predecessor Bush, George W. Bush increased the military spending. Of course, we were fighting the Iraq War. But unlike his two predecessors, Trump is going in the opposite direction when it comes to trade. And we'll talk about some of the negative impacts of that. And unlike his two predecessors, he is facing major geopolitical risk. I guess you could say George Bush faced political risk with the attacks of 9/11. And then, of course, he expanded and started the Iraqi war, which Trump has been a big critic of. But there are big geopolitical risks that are out there today. And those are some of those wild cards that are very difficult to assess in terms of how do you assess a terrorist attack or what may happen in Libya or what's happening in Syria or what's happening in the Balkans. These are the kind of things that are very difficult to gauge. But it's a very different environment that Trump is inheriting versus his predecessors, Bush and Obama.
Well, remember that both Presidents Bush and Obama came in pretty much in a recession at that point. And what we are here differently is we haven't entered that yet, you know, and we've been talking about the probability of a recession sometime next year. The real question is, as this nosedive down to a recession goes, would the Trump presidency actually sort of flatten out that dive, so to speak, and prolong the time before we enter into one, I guess, is the question that should be asked.
Well, I mean, there are a number of potentials here and there are a number of risks. The potentials for economic growth is, number one, cutting taxes and reform the tax code. It's so convoluted and complex. A regulatory freeze and rollback, which has stifled economic growth. Taxes and regulation have been two of the things that have been strangling the U.S. economy. And it's going to be a pro-business climate. You want to create jobs and high-paying jobs. Well, who's going to do that? It's going to be business. So those are some of the positive potentials for the economy. But there's also risk because he's also talking about protectionism, trade tariffs. There's also a situation that he inherits that his two predecessors did not have as much, and that is $20 trillion of U.S. debt. When George Bush came into office, the national debt was only $5 trillion. He doubled it to $10. Obama comes in, and he takes it from $10 trillion to $20 trillion. And that is going to have some limitation in terms of what Trump is going to be able to do, because at $20 trillion in debt, in the lowest interest rates in 5,000 years, that interest rate cycle is going in the opposite direction. And right now, overall government debt, the interest rate on that debt is around 2.25%. For every 1% increase in interest rates on treasuries, and don't forget, folks, 10-year treasuries have gone up over 1% since reaching a low in July of this year. An extra 1% in interest rates for the federal government costs the government $200 billion of interest expense. So that's going to add to the deficit. The other thing that is out there is we have never been in a more dangerous world geopolitically than where we are today. I mean, just take a look at the number of increased terrorist attacks, including the gentleman with the knife in the car at Ohio State. Look what's happening in Europe. Take a look at what's going on in Syria, in the Middle East, in Iraq right now, also in Libya, and also in the South China Sea. So the geopolitical risks are basically much larger that Trump is facing. And it's no surprise that he's named a number of high-powered and well-respected generals as Secretary of Defense and National Security Advisors. So that's a very strong message that he's sending. But he also, I think, senses the geopolitical risk that his presidency will face.
You know, this is a pretty established pattern because every president, when he comes in, is generally tested geopolitically. There's a lot of speculation right now that when Mr. Trump comes in, both the Chinese and the Russians are going to push him to see what he's going to do. You know, it's like two different strongmen on a playground trying to find out who's bigger and that type of thing. But they do it. There is historic precedence to that. And the odds are that Mr. Trump is going to face that early on. Okay, but now we're calling this the Trumpian Revolution, and obviously the testing would be part of the package. What do you think we can actually expect to see when he takes office next year?
Well, if you take a look at what he said during the election, the various appointments he's making to this cabinet, and some of the things he's emphasized after becoming president-elect. Number of things that he emphasized in the campaign, border security is right at the top of the list. Number two, repeal Obamacare. The Republicans never had a large enough majority in Congress to repeal Obamacare and override a presidential veto. And we know next year that Obamacare premiums are going up 25% on average. In some states like Arizona, it'll be over 100%. And Obamacare by itself will collapse of its own weight. So there's something that's going to be done with Obamacare. Now, whether they repeal it completely, which I doubt they can do because you do have 20 million, or they modify it and make it more workable. So that's on the agenda. Tax cuts are definitely coming as part of an economic package, including major economic stimulus coming in infrastructure spending, rebuilding defense. So tax cuts in fiscal spending. So what you're going to see is basically where monetary policy counteracted much of the negative anti-growth aspects of Obama's presidency with higher taxes and regulation, that was counteracted by the lowest interest rates and the loosest monetary policy we've seen in history. We saw that that didn't do much. So now we are moving from monetary stimulus to fiscal stimulus, and we'll get into that later on. And another element that is going to be raised, and he's promised, and he can do this with a stroke of the pen, is regulatory relief, which has just stymied and been strangling economic growth. So those are probably the four big factors that you're going to see put into place next year, and maybe even the first 100 days, depends on how lucky it can get, because we all know that a president can propose, but basically it's Congress that puts together the program. And so those are the things that we're going to see coming within the first 100 days of next year. Moving on, Obamacare, tax cuts and economic stimulus, whether it's infrastructure spending or defense, takes time to run through the system. It would be lucky if they could get dollars into the economy within 12 months.
Well, okay, let's assume that we start down this revolutionary path. I mean, obviously, as we've said here, the tax change is on the table. I guess the real question is how big, say, for example, can the deficit go, given the fact that we'll be right at $20 trillion when President Obama leaves and President-elect Trump is sworn in as president. And we're looking at an interest rate rise. Now, the real issue, I mean, there's the need for reform clear across the board. You know, from forfeiture laws to environmental laws, they are just wreaking havoc. Many government agencies out in flyover land, where people who live in what I call bubble land on the left or right coast don't always see this, but it is causing major anger and upset that was reflected in the election. The taxes are a nightmare. In other words, we have a tax code that is inscrutable by anyone, for that matter, because they can never even agree on what anybody owes. And there's reform across the board that's required. There's been a need for reform ever since the days of the Grace Commission back in the early 1990s. The real question is, can you really get that reform put through? Because you know, Jim, that what's going to happen is a couple of layers down in the bureaucracy. As soon as somebody reforms, what they're going to do is they're going to form a perimeter line against anyone that Mr. Trump appoints and do everything they can to neutralize him or her within their subsection of government. That's what they will do. Because a bureaucracy always defends its own best interest. And if we look at bureaucracy, one of the areas where real reform is needed is in the area of entitlements. Because what is it now? Is it 70%? I thought it was like 55% of government spending. I can't remember.
If you take entitlements and interest on the debt, that's 70% of government spending, and it's on autopilot.
So you're only monkeying with 30% when you're trying to do any budgetary. Without severe systemic reform, you're stuck monkeying around with just 30% of the whole budget.
Exactly. So how they're going to be able to do this, and this may be something that takes place over either the next president following Trump or a second Trump term, because if these things are putting into effect, and we'll talk about the deficit impacts here shortly, but let's begin, John, and talk about one of the first things that has been highlighted that they're talking about is tax cuts. Now, the Republicans have had a tax cut program in place for, what, 4 or 5 years. They just haven't been able to get it through the Senate. And even if they got it through the Senate, it would have been vetoed by President Obama. So if we take a look at the revenue potential loss of a Trump tax cut plan and a House GOP plan, the difference between the two over a 10-year period would be $6.1 trillion under Trump, $3.1 trillion under a GOP plan. Now, what they're talking about in both plans, both the Republican plan and the Trump plan, is reducing 7 tax rates down to 3. We would have a 12, a 25%, and a 33%. Trump would keep the capital gains rate at 20% where it is now, although there is a 3.8% Obama tax depending on your income. The House tax plan would drop capital gains down to 16.5%, and so there's a difference there. Now, they would also eliminate the AMT tax, which is capturing more middle-class taxpayers with itemized deductions. Now, here's the thing. You know, everybody's saying, oh, the rich are going to get away with, you know, just Trump being a billionaire. He's just going to favor his own class. That's not necessarily true, folks. The tax rate will go from 39.6 down to 33. But what Trump does is he caps itemized deductions. And remember, if you've been listening to the program or lifetime income, we've been talking about each administration over time has been moving towards getting rid of itemized deductions. If you are single, Trump would cap your itemized deductions at 100,000. If you're married, 200,000. So if you take Larry lots of bucks that makes a couple million dollars a year and lives in a state of, like I do in California, where the income tax is 13.3%, you know, tax on several million dollars, that's over $250,000 that you would pay the state of California. And not on top of that, there's property taxes. So Trump would cap itemized deductions, and the Republican plan would also cap itemized deductions. Now, a favorable thing is, I talked in hour one with Dave Nikoski, is Trump realizes you've got trillions of dollars overseas that aren't coming back here because corporations are basically going to say, why am I going to bring it back to the U.S. when the U.S. has the highest corporate tax rates at 35%. So Trump would lower corporate taxes to 15%. And it's part of the thing that he's pitching to, whether it's Carrier Corporation or Ford, are saying, look, we're going to make the tax environment here in the U.S. more favorable for you to keep your workers here and build your plants here rather than go overseas where you can shelter your income from high confiscatory taxes here. The Republican plan for corporate taxes would be 20 to 25%. So there's about a 10-point spread between Trump's tax plan and the Republican tax plan. And also, here's a big factor too, and folks, this is actually brilliant. All those trillions of dollars that are overseas, he wants to do the same thing that Bush did back in 2003, 2004. You bring it back here, we will give you a one-time tax rate. Trump would tax it at 10%. Folks, 10% of several trillion dollars is a lot more of 35% of $0. Because if we keep the tax rate at 35%, those dollars are going to remain overseas. Trump knows if that money comes back, he can also tax it twice. And let me tell you how he does that. You tax it first at 10%. The money comes back, you pay a 10% tax. Now, what do companies do when they have all that cash? They either buy back stock, they invest, or they distribute it to shareholders. If we take a look at what happened in 2003, 2004, when Bush did the same thing, about 40%, 45% of that money went into increased dividends and share buybacks. Well, what does the government do when a corporation pays a tax and then distributes a dividend to you? They tax it the second time. So under Trump, as a company brings that money back, they pay a 10% tax, and then they distribute it to you, the shareholder, it gets taxed again at your bracket of 20%. So there are a lot of similarities between the Republican plan and the Trump plan, but part of these infrastructure programs and things he wants to spend, he's going to need to raise some tax revenues to counteract what he's lowering the tax rates. And he wants to get faster economic growth, and he also wants to get tax revenues. Well, if you get 10% tax on, let's say 10% on $1 trillion of money that's repatriated back, and let's say half of that money gets redistributed to you, the shareholder, as dividends, 20% tax on that, he's going to raise some tax revenues to pay for part of this.
Okay, what do you think the impact on economic growth of all this will be? Because we have tax cuts that are different between Mr. Trump's plan and the one that the GOP originally had. And by the way, you can already see, you know, talk about headwinds, what you were talking of, which browsing through some articles in The Nation here, and they're already starting the back flush and opposition to any of these things as well. So, you know, we're in for a fight here. You can see this.
Yeah, I guess the difference between the two over a 10-year period, Trump's tax agenda would be roughly about 2.6% of GDP. The Republican plan, which would be about half of that in tax cuts, would be about a 1% of GDP. Economic growth would be faster under the Trump plan than the GOP plan. But that's what we're talking about. We're talking about increasing GDP.
Well, as I said, Jim, there's a lot of backflush and pushback on this already. I mean, theoretically, these plans are being analyzed, and you get lost in the crossfire of rhetoric. And you remember, we went through this with Obamacare, and you get the accusations, the counter accusations, the charges, a lot of misinformation that's spun around. Some people are deliberately spinning that, you know, like Mr. Obama would like to say, fake news. Well, it is in there. There's a lot of spin that goes on, and trying to weed it all out. So now, given the fact that Mr. Trump doesn't seem to care, is a lot of this going to fly through? Because I know the left just hates the idea of a tax cut.
Well, I mean, look what he comes into office, just like Obama came into office controlling both houses of Congress. Trump will do the same. The Republicans control the majority of governorships in this country. So he can do that with simply in the Senate with 51 votes, because this was a law that was changed and put into effect by Harry Reid when he was head of the Senate. Under the reconciliation part of the Senate, provisions that impact the deficit, that's tax cuts, tax hikes, spending cuts, and spending increases, could be put through the Senate with a simple 51 vote. So, first of all, Trump would have to have all the Republicans, there's 52 of them, and maybe some Democrats come along. So I think it's a pretty good possibility we are going to get the tax cuts that are going to come. Now, on the spending, well, infrastructure, there's an agreement between both Democrats and Republicans. So I don't see a problem getting the infrastructure spending, because Democrats love spending spending money just as much as Republicans when they're holding power. So the infrastructure spending, now the real key is going to be defense spending, which will be opposed by Democrats, but it may be offset with some kind of budget deal where maybe something's done on some kind of entitlement spending. There's going to be a give and take there when it comes to defense, and that's where I guess the jockeying and the art of the deal is going to come into play, because they both agree on infrastructure. That's not going to be a problem. Trump already has both houses of Congress to push through the reconciliation provisions to get the tax cuts. That's not going to be a problem. I think the problem is going to be on defense spending, which is a big no-no with the Democrats, because they've brought down, and we'll get into defense spending here shortly. So that is going to be where the deals are cut. Now, the next thing, it could be done, and this can affect trade. He doesn't need Congress. There are a number of things that Trump can simply do under the president. He has the authority to act under NAFTA, the Trade Expansion Act of 1962, the Trade Act of 74, and Trading with the Enemy Act of 1917. So there are a number of things the president can do with executive orders on trade that he doesn't need Congress. So you're probably going to see something come on the trade where he's basically going to go to companies, look, hey, I'm lowering the income taxes, the corporate tax rate. I'm getting rid of regulations, which, by the way, John, the number one complaint by businesses in terms of stagnating the economy, believe it or not, wasn't taxes. It was regulation, which is just killing. So he can unwind those without even going through Congress. So you're going to see a lot of things come forward that he'll do simply unilaterally, just as Obama did with executive orders.
When we think about when we went through the last recession and shed all those jobs, companies were forced to find ways to be more productive and more efficient, and they had to reduce cost. Mm-hmm. And then they were able to do that, obviously, through technology and other ways, and they didn't bring the jobs back. And some of those jobs did go overseas. But I do believe there's an opportunity here. And I think that Trump and his administration will be able to find ways to drive policies and incentives to get employers hiring again. This could be very good for the job market.
So in the light of this, obviously everybody seems to be talking about change. You can see that major changes are coming to economy and to Washington. It depends on your point of view too, by the way. Some negative, some positive. Let's look at that.
Well, let's take a look at the good and the bad. On the good side, corporate tax cuts are good because that will stimulate investment. And if they have that repatriation one-time tax of 10% or 8.5%, depending on when it works out, that money will be coming back. That will be positive. A lot of the tax cuts that Trump is talking about, increasing the standard deduction to $15,000 for single individuals, $30,000 for married couples, middle-class tax cuts would help consumption. That would be good. Less regulation would be good. Infrastructure spending, everybody agrees, would also be good for the economy. However, there are some negatives. If he gets involved in a trade war, protectionist policies, and depending on how they work out the tax benefits, if it goes disproportionately to the upper income individuals, then that wouldn't be as good. But as I take a look at it, if you cap itemized deductions at $100,000 to $200,000, those tax cuts for the wealthy aren't going to be as big as the left is proposing, because if you're a wealthy individual, you're paying state taxes like California, 13.3, you're paying 10% in Oregon, you're paying 8.9 in New Jersey. I mean, that adds up to a lot of money. And if you start losing those deductions, that means you're going to be paying tax at 33% on those deductions that you lose. So if you take a look at the corporate tax cuts, the repatriation would be good for a CapEx cycle, businesses investing. It would also be good for capital stock. It would help productivity. You would see a rising labor force participation, rising real income, stronger GDP, and a smaller trade gap. The negatives are you could see short-term spikes in interest rates, as we're seeing now, longer-term disruptions. There's also risk of a global trade war. Hey, if you're going to put tariffs on our goods, they can do the same thing. So that wouldn't be very good if we got involved in a trade war.
But as you and Dave Nikoski were talking about in the first hour of the program, you know, okay, the stock market's going up in anticipation of these things. But, you know, we've also seen a rise in yields. And that could also counteract some of the things you're talking about.
We saw that immediately following the election. I mean, it's hard to believe that in July of this year, we were at 1.3% on a treasury bond, and we're almost at 2.5% as we speak on this Friday. But a lot of this was already in place, and part of the move was attributable to what we call the higher term premium and higher inflation expectations. Trump's policies, like it or not, are reflationary and are going to increase the deficit. The break-even rates and term premiums have been increasing ever since the election. And the story is similar at a global level. We're seeing global term premiums and break-evens going up in Germany and Japan. I mean, folks, just take a look at where negative interest rates were this summer and where they are now since Trump's election. So we were already seeing that. Oil prices had already stabilized in that sort of 40 to 50 range. Now we're above 50. We'll talk about oil here in a second. But the term premiums on the bond market were already increasing because there was, number one, less anxiety after Brexit. The big change of mind from foreign central banks, too low rates are not good, as the Japanese have found out with negative interest rates in Japan. People just hoarded their money. They didn't spend it. And also, you know, when Trump's talking about increasing military spending, he's talking about infrastructure spending and cutting tax cuts, everybody knows that that is going to be a bigger deficit. Now, the one negative thing that he is facing, his administration, that were different than George Bush and what we saw with Obama, is a more hawkish Fed. If we take a look at all the Fed governors, Williams, Powell, Bullard, Kaplan, Hawker, Fisher, Rosengren, and Meister, Lacker, George, they are all on the hawkish side. Basically, the dovish side is Dudley and Yellen. So what we've seen happen since the election is when it comes to raising interest rates or hikes by the Fed, we've always gone by the futures market, which has been more accurate. What we've seen from the election is a convergence between the futures market and the Fed dot plot. And right now, they're anticipating by the end of next year, the Fed funds rate could be somewhere in the neighborhood of 1.9%, which would imply basically 4 rate hikes coming in 2017. But remember, folks, anything can change that, because in 2016, we started out anticipating 4 rate hikes. It looks like we'll only get 1, just like we did in 2015. So a lot's going to happen in terms of what happens with inflation, what happens with oil prices, and what happens to economic growth. If the economy starts to falter and the PMIs peak, as we anticipate, you could see weakness going into the first half, and we could be altering expectations in the marketplace about rate hikes. So we already have a reaction that we've seen in anticipation of what may happen as a result of Trump's policies. The rise in the stock market, the rise in the dollar, the rise in oil prices, and the rise in interest rates. In my own estimation, I think this market has gotten way ahead, both on the dollar, both on interest rates, and the stock market.
Of course, we've been seeing this rally come out ever since Donald Trump was elected president on November 8th. But these two guys, they're saying beware the Trump rally. First to Bill Gross, he's telling people, listen, taking a look at what's been happening in terms of what Trump has been saying in terms of tax cuts, the cut from 35% to 15%, infrastructure spending potentially as much as $1 trillion, and of course, looser laws, deregulation here will mean faster growth. Well, he's Bill Gross is saying, think again, guys. He's saying, look at the stronger dollar. It's up about 4.5% now. Earlier, our guest was saying that it could continue to be stronger, and that could have a knock-on effect, especially, of course, among emerging markets there. Aging demographics as well and higher debt-to-GDP ratio, all of that is heading on over to productivity, and productivity perhaps coming in at 1% in terms of an annual growth rate, and he says, therefore, real GDP growth at 2% there.
That was from Bloomberg, and he's quoting Bill Gross here, and what he's saying is rising interest rates and a rising dollar not good for the economy, so you shouldn't necessarily buy into this Trump rally.
Well, you got to remember, Bill Gross is a bond guy. That's where he made his money. And obviously, deficit spending, rising inflation is not good for bonds. But I think Gross needs to be a realist here. We got down to the lowest interest rates in recorded human history. there's no other place for interest rates to go but up, which is not going to be good news for the type of investments Bill Gross manages, because he's going to be managing in a rising interest rate environment, which is a lot more difficult, less capital gains than in a falling interest rate environment. But right now, we've got the stock market hitting record highs. Bond yields are rising. We've gone from 1.32 this summer to roughly about 2.5 right now, and the dollar is rising. So there are some major risks here to this whole scenario. And I think Gross was correct in pointing this out, as Dave Nikoski and I talked about in hour one. Rising interest rates, and if the Fed was to get overly hawkish, basically, they get some good economic numbers, inflation starts to heat up, and all of a sudden, they start getting more aggressive. Because remember, every single U.S. recession was preceded by Fed rate hikes. What they keep doing, John, is they keep raising rates until they crash the system. And they never learn. You know, these guys are academics. Nobody at the Fed comes from the trading floor. Nobody at the Fed comes from the business community. And, you know, these guys are academics, and they think in theoretical models that are irrelevant and don't work. So there are risks of rising interest rates and a rising dollar. Although a rising dollar would be good on the inflationary front, meaning our imports would be cheaper. But then there's also the risk of rising inflation. Let's say the Fed isn't as hawkish. So there are some risks here to this scenario. You could actually have some countervailing moves to positive fiscal stimulus. What good does it do if the positive fiscal stimulus is counteracted by negative monetary policy?
I think that depends on how quickly a new Trump administration decides to enact with budget reconciliation as a means for pushing through a variety of different stimulative measures rather quickly and twice next year. I think that could accelerate the pace of Fed tightening beyond what is currently expected, four or more times. If the Trump administration gets everything that it wants and Paul Ryan gets everything he wants and they finance the tax cuts with Medicare privatization or something like that, this stuff could happen pretty quickly. And I think it would be welcomed by the Fed, but surprising to us.
Yeah, and in terms of the environment that Mr. Trump is heading into, you have to recognize it's totally different from the type of environment into which either Mr. Bush or Mr. Obama inherited and entered into. We have a weakening economy that's really right now long in the tooth. It sort of made its run before a recession. The Fed is raising interest rates instead of lowering them. Remember, previously for both presidents before, the Fed was lowering it. So you could have a president at odds with the Federal Reserve. And given these varied conditions, which are not the same as previous two presidents, what are the possibilities this could go in a different direction?
Well, it is, because both Obama and Bush inherited stimulus that was already in the pipeline with Fed rate cuts as they began their administration. And that's just the opposite of what Trump faces. He faces an extended, long business cycle in terms of how long business cycles have lasted. This is already 7 years, almost 8 years. And so that is typically longer than most business cycles. So whether he can stretch this out another couple of years is going to require that a number of these things come into play all at the same time, because we're seeing right now swap spreads are rising. The yield curve is steepening. Now, that's good news for banks, because a steeper yield curve would encourage them to lend. But also, if the economy was to weaken, remember, a steepening yield curve is good and profitable for banks, but also makes it more expensive for businesses or consumers to borrow. Mortgage rates are up, car loan rates are up. So all of this stuff starts to go up. So the real question is, can the stimulus offset rising interest rates and a rising dollar? Now, here's one thing that, you know, rising interest rates and an expanding economy is good for the dollar. It would cause the dollar to rise. But there's also a countervailing weakening to the dollar that comes with inflation. In other words, if the inflation starts to rise first in the U.S., that would weaken the dollar. So the debate, the stimulus could be offset by the dollar, by interest rates and rising oil. If oil prices rise too much, we could see Just as it was a stimulus when consumers were paying less at the gas pump, it is also contractionary in terms of consumer spending if gasoline prices rise at the pump. Now, that could be offset with tax cuts that were aimed at the middle class coming from Trump. But right now, the monetary cycle is in an expansionary mode. U.S. money supply is up almost 9% year over year, and there's really no danger. I mean, if the Fed does raise this December, there will be the second rate hike. You really don't have a risk when the Fed begins a rate raising cycle. Think back to 2004 when the Fed under Greenspan was raising rates every single Fed meeting, a quarter of a point. It really wasn't until we got the Fed funds rate up in the 3% range that we began to run into trouble beginning in 2006. So the first rate hikes are not really troublesome. I think it really happens now with this kind of debt is when you get the Fed funds rate over 1%. And if the Fed raises in December, the Fed funds rate would be at 0.75%. So you could probably see a couple rate hikes coming in the first part of the year, because right now, we've seen a convergence of both the futures market and the dot plot map of the Fed showing rate hikes, two or three rate hikes coming in the first part of the year. But once again, this is all, I hate to say this word, data dependent. So as rates rise with rising inflation, loan availability will eventually tighten.
I think it's clear while Mr. Trump has talked generally about issues related to energy, I think there's two key areas we should focus on. The first one is he's commented about the need to review the regulatory tsunami, if you will, that we've been dealing with. We have 145 pending regulations on the oil and gas industry right now that we're dealing with as this administration concludes its service. So a focus on there to make sure we're regulating the industry smartly, not overburdening it, not chilling the investment opportunities. But the second piece we've been heartened by is his focus on infrastructure. As you know, right now, there's opportunities potentially for Keystone Pipeline, for the Dakota Access Pipeline. Recent studies show there's a potential $1.1 trillion in infrastructure investment. These are private sector dollars just from the energy opportunities.
That was Jack Girard, who's president of the American Petroleum Institute. And we know that energy production has really been stymied by the avalanche of regulations targeted against coal and the energy industry in general, although you might have to put a little exception in there for alternative sources of energy like wind and solar, which aren't doing too well on their own. But the ones against the hydrocarbon industry, you know, natural gas, coal, oil, that could be removed with an executive pen easily. I mean, Keystone may yet get built. Now, however, to a lot of people's surprise, OPEC finally decided to cut production this week. And of course, prices are going up. Is this a geopolitical move or is this a strategic economic move?
You know, I think it's a strategic economic move. If you take a look at what the Saudis did, and we look at the timeline, it began in November of 2014 at an OPEC meeting. Saudi Arabia basically said, we're not going to cut back on production. And that's when the precipitous drop in oil began in November, taking oil prices down from over $100 a barrel down to $26 a barrel. Then there was another OPEC meeting in June where basically they shocked the oil market and they said, nope, we're going to keep pumping. In fact, we're going to start pumping more. And the idea was they thought they could drive U.S. shale producers out of business and therefore take U.S. production down. And then eventually, as U.S. production went offline, then the prices would firm. Well, guess what? It backfired. They tried to get a freeze deal in Doha, but it collapsed after Saudi Arabia refused to take part without Iran. And one of the things, as we talked about in the first hour with Robert Rapier, the reason I think this deal came together is the Trump presidency weakened basically Iran's position at the negotiating table. Because basically Trump, because there was never an official treaty ratified by the Senate with Iran, Trump could reverse that deal and basically allow sanctions to go into effect. And we'll get into that. But basically, If you take a look at this, OPEC would like to see oil prices stabilize in the $60 to $70 range. Remember, as we talked about in hour one, you know, OPEC has lost $1 trillion in revenue. Saudi Arabia is basically talking about taking its company Aramco public. They've raised money in the debt markets. They've gone through a third of their foreign currency reserves. If you look at Venezuela, their economy is on the verge of collapse, poor mismanagement, and lower oil prices. It worked for Chavez as long as oil prices were skyrocketing as they were in the last decade when we got up to $150. But there are a couple of key things that came out of this. There were four pillars that Saudi Arabia was negotiating on. One, the action must be collective. They're basically saying to the other members, hey guys, it's just not going to be us. Okay, we'll shoulder the bulk of the cuts, but you guys are going to have to kick in too. It must be equitable in terms of the ability to produce and how the cuts are distributed. It has to be transparent. None of this stuff, okay, I'll cut, and then we know notoriously that OPEC cheats. And then it also must be perceived as credible with the markets. Well, so far, I would say it is credible because we've seen the price of oil move on this Friday. We're up almost to $52 a barrel. So what it looks like, Iraq is going to cut part of its production. Iran is going to freeze its production. In other words, they won't increase it. But here's the real key thing here. And this could have nothing to do with OPEC itself. It could have to do with what President Trump can do, because he could tear up that agreement with Iran and remove almost a million barrels a day of supply at the stroke of a pen. And he's not going to have to depend on other OPEC members. He could simply put in, as he has called this, a disastrous deal. It wasn't ratified by Congress, so he could rescind it. And it's the perceived breach of the deal that basically got Iran to the negotiating table, because they are now coming at a weak position. As a result of the deal, we've seen Iran's exports go from under a million barrels in November of 2015 to today's exports of 2.5 million barrels. So basically, John, he could put those sanctions in effect, and he could also end Iranian oil flows into Europe. So one of the best friends of OPEC and the U.S. energy industry could be the Trump presidency itself. Because right now, as we take a look at oil storage levels, and this is something Robert and I talked about in hour one, you've got the various pads around the country, and we've got about five of them. If we take a look at pad one, which is East Coast, it's operating at 81% utilization, which means it doesn't have much more to fill. If we take a look at pad two, which is basically operating at 50% capacity, pad three is operating at 65%, pad four is 76%, pad five is 52%, in Cushing, which a lot of the futures market operates, is operating at a 77% fill. So we still have a lot of oil that is in storage in building. But the weather forecasters are saying that we could be facing one of the coldest winters that we've seen in a long time. Also, we could see a change in the energy market, John. For the first time, the U.S. has gone from a importer of natural gas as a result of the shale revolution to an exporter of natural gas. So Trumponomics could expand energy production, which could counteract some of the things that Saudis are doing. And that's why when we were talking with Robert Rapier in the first hour, he thinks that this first production cut is not going to be enough, and that there's probably going to need to be another second production cut, taking an additional million barrels off in production. So Saudi production would go from 33.5 million barrels down to 31.5 million barrels. And if Trump was to renege on basically through executive orders, the Iranian deal, that would take a million barrels offline overnight. So I would say that the energy market has bottomed, and we could probably look forward to higher energy prices. That's not going to be good news for consumers. It's also going to be good news, believe it or not, for the stock market, because one of the reasons earnings have been in decline for five quarters is the energy and materials sector. You could see if energy prices stabilize in the $50 to $60 level, energy would contribute 40% increase into sales and earnings in the S&P next year. So in conclusion, energy is going to be a greater contributor to economic growth here in the U.S., just like the shale revolution did in this economic recovery, as well as corporate earnings.
Before we wrap out this conversation, I think we need to talk about geopolitical risk, because things are changing rapidly. Before we did the show today, I was reviewing a lot of the things going on around the world. We talked about Donald Trump being tested, and I know there are a number of intelligence voices that are saying you can expect this to happen, that both China and Russia will probably do something to see what he's made of. But this is also that wild card that is difficult to predict. And then the question is about defense spending, which, ironically, of all the things the government spends its money on, is one of those things the Constitution actually provides for. But if you look at the appointment of General Mattis as to, now this has yet to go through, there's some controversy about it, but as the proposed Secretary of Defense, this really sends a strong message around the world.
It does. And if you take a look at defense spending, take out cost for operations, maintenance, and personnel, it is actually at a record low. It's the lowest it's been since the Vietnam War. Typically, it averages, when you exclude personnel costs, between 2 and 2.5%. That's the stuff you're spending on weapons. That's ships, that's planes, that's rockets, guns. That is average about 2, 2.5. We are actually below 2% right now. And part of that came with the sequester. So if you're talking about increasing and what the Defense Department says it needs, you need a good $100 billion to upgrade our equipment. So I know here, John, San Diego's home to 4 carrier battle groups, and every time a carrier comes in town, they're scrounging for parts on the planes. So what you could see is $50 billion a year coming into spending for defense, $100 billion over a 2-year period, so as not to drive up the deficit too large. And the same thing when it comes to infrastructure spending. Trump has talked about $1 trillion of spending over a 10-year period, part of it financed publicly through deficit spending, and basically government would finance it, and also a private partnership with industry. So between the two, you could see between $100 and $150 billion of infrastructure spending that would be coming with the Trump administration. The infrastructure would be the easiest one to get through Congress. As I mentioned earlier, I think he's going to get his tax cuts, everything he wants to get through. That can happen with just the way the Senate has worked. It was changed under Harry Reid, so it'll make it easier now that the Republicans control Congress to do the same thing the Democrats did. And also, Trump occupies the White House, so that's coming through. I think there will be widespread agreement on the infrastructure spending. The defense spending, there's going to be some horse trading there, because Democrats would probably oppose that. And, you know, the thing about all of this is he wrote the book, The Art of the Deal. And I suspect that's what's going to be happening in the first half of 2017. There's going to be a lot of deal making going place.
Let us see, now that we have come this far in the conversation, let's see if we can distill this down to the significance of all of this for investments.
Well, I mean, if you look at historical evidence, two of the biggest bull markets, 1953 to 1974 or 1982 to 1999, were preceded by Republican Revolution. It began with Eisenhower. Everybody remembers the highway system that Eisenhower put into place when he came into office, and the big spending on infrastructure from power plants and roads. If we go forward to the Reagan Revolution, it began with tax cuts and deregulation. So there are a lot of experts that are looking at Trump, and he's not your normal Republican. He's talking about taxes. He's talking about deregulation. So some are saying he's sort of a mixture between Eisenhower and Reagan. Now, what are going to be the consequences of this? One, inflation is going to be on the rise. Number two, interest rates are going to be on the rise. However, those two things are going to encourage business investment and consumer spending, very similar to what we saw in the 50s and the 80s. And I think you're also going to be seeing, as Dave Nikoski and I talked in hour number one, basically a seismic shift in the financial markets from a, what I call, bond investment market by the public to a rotation out of bonds, because as interest rates rise, especially for all of those individuals that have money in bond funds, they are going to start to experience losses. As, for example, we've seen already this year, where you've seen all the gains in, you know, bond funds or ETFs like TLT and LQD have been given up since the election. So there are going to be a lot of things that are going to take place here, and it's going to be a seismic shift. And I predict, you know, basically that the new bonds will be stocks, because not only will there be increased dividend yields, especially if we see a huge repatriation of cash, the $1 trillion that are overseas that would probably get a one-time low tax rate of 10% to 8.5%. Some of that money is going to be coming back in the way of dividends and stock buybacks. But if you take a look at the key things here, credit leads equities and regimes supersede business cycles. So if everything was to go perfectly here, and that's still a big if, this business cycle can be extended. And if it's extended, we could possibly avoid a recession, because prior to Trump's victory, we were looking at a peak in the PMIs. We were looking at a slowing economy. We were looking at falling corporate profits. 5 quarters in a row, we're now starting to see that could change, especially in the energy sector, which can contribute up to 40% of the gains of the S&P next year. So this could be a game changer. But once again, it is fraught with a lot of risk. So there are a number of things that could go wrong.
I'm just thinking here, if something could go wrong, what might that go wrong be?
Well, I mean, right now, the market, you had a lot of money that was sitting on the sidelines ahead of the election. People were sitting in cash and saying, you know what, we're going to hold off making a bet. We'll see what the outcome is. I think a lot of those bets are being placed right now. But I think this market has gotten ahead of itself, both in interest rate rises. I mean, when you go from prior to the election, we are at 1.8, we are almost at 2.5. I mean, that, folks, is a big, steep run up in interest rates. The stock market is at all-time records in anticipation of these tax cuts and spending. But even if they were to get through the tax cuts, the infrastructure spending may not start taking place till the end of 2017. The tax cuts, if they make them retroactive to the beginning of the year, most people won't feel it, because they will be having their tax withholding based on 2016 taxes. They're probably not going to feel a lot of that unless they make some adjustments. So this is going to take a while for this stuff to work its way through the pipeline into the economy. All of this right now is moving on perception and thinking of what may take place in the future. Another risk is the Fed makes a monetary mistake and gets way too aggressive in its rate hikes. If you take a look at the Fed funds future, they have rate hikes coming at the first 3 meetings of the year. So we could be over a 1% federal funds rate. The dot plot and the futures market is anticipating a Fed funds rate at the end of 2017 of close to 1.9%. That would be very aggressive. That's basically 5 rate hikes coming next year. Another problem. China is dealing with a massive credit problem, a massive malinvestments as a result of the infrastructure spending on see-through cities and factories that are too many. And also, the other thing that could happen is inflation, especially if energy prices jump. Let's say Trump reneges on the Iranian deal, takes 1 million barrels of Iraqi oil offline. So, John, there are a lot of things that could go wrong here. I mean, this is going to be a delicate strategy to pursue, because Trump is inheriting a weakening economy. He's inheriting a tightening monetary policy rather than a loosening monetary policy like his predecessors had. And we're not in a recession now. The economy is still growing. Bush took office, we were in a recession, the Fed was loosening. Obama took office, we were in a recession, the Fed was loosening. Trump is taking office, we're still in an economic recovery, although it's getting late, but the Fed is tightening. So there's two different circumstances as he moves in.
Okay, let me see if I can sum all of this out. What all of this means. Number one, we'll have a revolution in terms of economic policy and geopolitical strategy. Those are two core areas, which means, number two, there will be a major sea change to the investment markets. And you have to plan for that, not only in lifetime planning, you know, for retirement, but also just for general investment. Number three, they'll be moving from an emphasis or dependence on monetary policy to a dependence on fiscal stimulus in the form of tax cuts and both infrastructure and defense spending, both of things which are really necessary. The infrastructure is crumbling. And defense spending, if you look at where things are geostrategically and what other countries are doing and building up various things, we need to do that. Number four, a major shift in deregulation, especially in energy. Number five, we'll be moving from falling interest rates to rising rates, which anticipates here a shift from bonds to equities because of that. And finally, there is going to be geopolitical risk. We know that we're already in unstable situations in certain parts of the world, but that some of our adversaries out there are going to test the mettle of the new president. And that is a given. And people are already discussing that, not just here economically, but also in the defense sectors. So given that, Jim, here we are down toward the end of the year. And then, of course, we'll have 20 days into January before the change of power occurs. What are we looking at for monetary? I'm going to guess here in December, one of the big things will be, will she or won't she?
Yeah, I think it's pretty much conclusive at this time. She will. Just like last year, what is not clear, will we follow the same path as we did last year? I mean, they were very optimistic when they raised in December of last year, predicting 4 rate hikes for 2016. Here we are in the month of December, and we're only going to get 1 rate hike, just like we did in 2015. So we'll be watching to see how the markets react, what happens to credit spreads. And also, we're going to be monitoring the Christmas season to see what's happening with online sales, brick mortar sales. Does that consumer confidence, which has risen since the presidential election and the election of Donald Trump, does that translate into higher spending this holiday season? So two of the things we're watching, we got a decent jobs report on Friday. We're going to be watching the PMIs. Are they ready to peak or will they get extended as a result of President-elect Trump and the policies that could be forthcoming in 2017? But I would say in the month of December, two things, well, actually three, they'll be watching cabinet post, who's going to be Secretary of State. That's another big one that's coming up that we should know in the next month. The Fed meeting, and then Christmas sales. All of that coming up in the weeks ahead. We'll be here to talk about it. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.